Senate Rules Committee to order. It's still early in the session, so we haven't gotten the punctuality thing down quite yet, but we will. So welcome to Senate Rules. And today we have a short but important agenda. We have before us SCR 3. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 3. Sheree.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 remembers and honors the victims of the Ukraine famine of 1932 to 1933 and designates November 25th, 2017 as Holodomor Remembrance Day. There is one amendment to this bill. The Dash 1 amendment simply clarifies information regarding the number of deaths attributed to the famine. The fiscal and revenue paperwork indicates that there is no impact as a result of this measure.
Okay, and welcome, Senator Montes Anderson. You're going to become an honorary member of the committee here.
That's right.
Soon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. I'm very honored to bring before you Senate Resolution 3. I had Tatiana Turdahl and her husband, Paul, and Pastor Globeck come to me and talk to me about, and I'm never going to say it right, but a Holodomor resolution that we need to do. It is extremely important, I think, for the Oregon legislature to look at our history, no matter where it is in the world, to see how many atrocities have happened in our history and that they've been inflicted on other people. And it's really terrible when they pick out a certain race. And so we know that we are having problems with the Muslim community at the federal level. And so I want us to remember that the Holodomor, it was a forced famine in 1932 to 1933, ordered by Stalin. And it caused the death of at least 5 million people. And it's important for us to remember events like this. Now, the reason I got involved with this, because I'm going to let Tatiana and the people who are here give the history and more in detail about what happened. But many members of the Ukrainian community live in my district. These are members of the local Ukrainian language and Russian language churches, and they're some of the biggest churches, and I'm going to cite each one. The Ukrainian Bible Church, it's 100% Ukrainian membership. There's approximately 1,000 people, adults and children, and about 50%, including Pastor Ilya Globak, they live close to the church within 15 to 20-minute drive. And the other 50% live in Clackamas, Vancouver, and other areas. Then there's the Slavic Evangelical Church, Sulamita. It's also located in Fairview. It has about 70% Ukrainian membership and about 2,000 members total, adults and children. There's the New Life Missionary Church, and I won't say his name right, but it's Pastor Vakulski. They have about 70% Ukrainian membership and about 1,000 members, adults and children. And finally, the God Will Provide Evangelical Church, about 70% Ukrainian membership and about 500 members. So overall, there's about 4,000 Ukrainian Americans that have come to the Gresham area to church on Sundays and during the other weeks of the week, other days of the week. And I am so proud to have them as members of my community. And it's really important for them to share your story. And with that, I will turn this presentation over to those who know this issue much better than I do.
Thank you very much. Does the committee have any questions or comments before we lose Senator Montes Anderson?
And I have another committee I'm supposed to go to, so I apologize, but I'll be able to look at this online later on.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. Okay, we will have three people come up now, Tatiana Turdahl, Ihor Levkiv, and Margarita Smolyanska. And then when you give your name, I'll find out if I was close in my pronunciation.
Very close, very good.
I did have 2 years of Russian.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tatiana Turdal. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes, you don't
You're
need
good.
To get close to it.
Okay, I am board member of the Ukrainian American Cultural Association of Oregon and Southwest Washington. So I want to start by just introducing you a bit to our Ukrainian community here in Oregon and telling you about our organization. Okay. So there are tens of thousands of Ukrainians living in Oregon. It's a bit difficult to find very accurate information on exactly how many. I found that some of the government data, like the census data, I think is underreporting the number of people. Partly I think it's based on the methodology, partly maybe because the population is primarily religious refugees from government persecution in the Soviet Union, and they're not very eager to share a lot of information with the government just because of the bad experiences. So what I found is that community surveys, I think, get a bit closer to, say, how many people of Ukrainian descent live in Oregon. But it's definitely tens of thousands. So the majority of people of Ukrainian descent in our state came here as religious refugees in the late 80s, early 90s from the former Soviet Union. But we also have people who came here for work. They are tech professionals. We have researchers who came to OSU and OHSU because of the type of research that these institutions pursue here, and very good lab equipment, they told me. We also have a significant number of second and third generation Ukrainian Americans coming here from other states that have maybe older Ukrainian communities, but they want to come to Oregon for the quality of life and for the jobs. Some of our prominent Oregonians are also of Ukrainian descent. For example, the founder of Powell's Books, Michael Powell, is a son of a Ukrainian immigrant. A lot of Ukrainians are organized around their religious communities. We have a number of different churches. There are several evangelical churches in the Fairview, Portland, Milwaukee, Gresham areas, also in Vancouver, Washington, Federal Way. There is also a Ukrainian Orthodox Church in the Selva neighborhood of Portland, and actually Michael Powell was one of the people who fundraised to turn this residential building into Ukrainian Orthodox Church. There is also Nativity of the Mother of God Ukrainian Catholic Church in Springfield. Mm-hmm. In addition to places of worship, there are many other institutions like the Ukrainian School of Knowledge, Ukrainian Federal Credit Union, many restaurants and cafes and grocery shops. Ukrainian Federal Credit Union is an institution that was established by the Ukrainian immigrants who came to the East Coast in 1950s after the Second World War. And until recently, there were really no branches on the West Coast. But now, within the last 10 years, we have now two branches here in Portland and in Vancouver, and I think in other West Coast states. So it kind of shows you that there are now so many Ukrainians in this area that it's enough to support a Ukrainian-based bank. This bank provides a lot of small business loans for people of Ukrainian descent who want to start small businesses. Our association is as diverse as our community in general. We have people who are first-generation Ukrainians, second- and third-generation Ukrainians, and also people who have no, like, official blood relation to Ukraine, but just are interested in culture and language. So we do a lot of educational activities, lectures, presentations, showcases of our culture. Just last Saturday, we were part of the Washington County Museum's Family Day, showing different New Year's traditions around the world. We organize also events for the community, festival, concerts, and we also have a community magazine which comes out in three different languages, Ukrainian, Russian, and English. So this is just a community magazine. We also do a lot of charity work, especially in the last few years. After Russia invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea, we've been doing a lot of work to support and help support over 1.8 million internal refugees within Ukraine. So we've advocated, we also partnered with other nonprofits here in Oregon to do that work. We advocated with Mercy Corps to encourage Mercy Corps to start working in Ukraine and use their considerable experience in working in areas of natural disaster and humanitarian crisis. Right now they have offices in eastern Ukraine, so there are some pictures from their offices there. And one of the programs they do there is small grants program, basically livelihoods. Medical Teams International is a wonderful Tigard-based nonprofit that has donated two full containers of medical supplies that we helped ship to Ukraine and distribute to Ukrainian hospitals. World Defense Council of Oregon from time to time has delegations that come from Ukraine. Next month they'll have a delegation that will come and will be studying regional development here in Oregon. So we provide support for those programs too. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Great. I think we'll take the rest of the testimony and then we'll open it up for questions. Must go next.
Great. So, dear Chair, dear Senators, members of the Legislative Committee, my name is Igor Levkiv. I'm the President of Ukrainian American Cultural Association. I work for Daimler Trucks North America. I'm an international service manager taking care of the service account in Latin America, Asia Pacific, Middle East and Africa. I came to the United States almost 24 years ago, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I would like to give you some more details on the Holodomor of 1932-1933. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. This is the words that belong to George Santayana. They were dying, 17 people each minute, 1,000 each hour, 25,000 each day. This was the terrible harvest by the Ukrainian famine genocide, by the terrible famine genocide in Ukraine. Ukrainian famine genocide, or Holodomor in Ukrainian, was one of the largest national catastrophes of the Ukrainian nation in the modern history, with the direct loss of human life in the range of millions. The estimated number of victims of the famine is estimated between 4 to 10 million. Nobody knows exactly the exact number. The word Holodomor comes from Ukrainian word holod, or hunger, and the more epidemic, possibly from the expression morete holodom in Ukrainian, which means to inflict death by hunger. Ukrainian morete means to poison somebody, drive to exhaustion, or to torment somebody. Perfect form of the verb morete is zamorete, kill or drive to death by hunger, exhausting work. The land that was known worldwide as a breadbasket of the Europe was being ravaged by a man-made famine genocide of unprecedented scale. Stalin and his followers were determined to teach Ukrainian farmers a lesson they would not forget, for resisting collectivization, which meant giving them their land to work on a government-controlled farm. Genocide is a deliberate and systematic destruction of the racial, political, or cultural group. Just as the Jewish Holocaust is not simply a Jewish issue, the genocide famine in Ukraine is not simply a Ukrainian issue. Both genocides have universal implications. The Holocaust is an example of genocide perpetrated by an openly racist fascist regime, which had as its acknowledged purpose the extermination of the Jewish people, the Ukrainian genocide famine is an example of genocide perpetrated by a communist regime. The West is hardly aware of the Holodomor, even having taken place. This occurred for the following reasons: consistent denial by the Soviet officials and conscious cover-up by influential Western correspondents reporting from Moscow, a lack of information about the Soviet Union crimes within its own border, crimes that since the collapse of the Soviet Union appeared to be fading from public consciousness both here and abroad, an information vacuum regarding Ukraine and its people among American universities and the general public, where the prevailing view was that Ukrainians were Russians who spoke a Russian dialect. The three major objectives were behind the orchestration of the genocide famine by the Soviet government in the desire to expand empire of the former Union of the Soviet Socialistic Republics, or USSR, to destroy a significant portion of that segment of the Ukrainian population which had most loudly and openly resisted increasingly oppressive Soviet rule, to terrorize the surviving Ukrainian population into compliance to Soviet totalitarian domination, to provide funds for Soviet industrial expansion from the sale of expropriated Ukrainian wheat and other foodstuff to the rest of the world. The following countries have recognized Ukrainian famine as a genocide: Argentina, Australia, Canada, Czech Republic, Ecuador, Estonia, Georgia, Hungary, Italy, Lithuania, Peru, Poland, Ukraine, and the United States of America. Why we think it is important? Ukrainian American Cultural Association of Oregon and Ukrainian community in Portland matter would like to decide by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon the Ukrainian famine of 1932-1933 as an act of genocide against the Ukrainian nation and these painful memories, and share it with all Oregonians so that we all make ourselves strong against the power of lies and ideologies of hate, that we all strive to work together for the human dignity of all, that we prevent future famine genocides, that we train Oregon students to be vigilant of violence or violations of the human rights, and learn about this painful Ukrainian history in public schools, colleges, and universities. Education of the process of genocides is important because it helps people recognize the discriminatory patterns that can lead to genocide and what constitutes genocide, which may aid in its prevention. And at the end, I would like to read the poem written by Eugenia Dallas. She is an American poet of Ukrainian descent that went through this Holodomor genocide. Peaceful, hardworking, happy, gregarious people with their golden fields of wheat, blue skies, Ukraine, my country, breadbasket of Europe. Suddenly, black clouds of terror from the neighbor to the north, darkness blew over the green hills, the peaceful, golden steppes of Ukraine. Bullets riddled my country. They took my freedom, my land, and brutally turned us into colony, run by hostile, ruthless outsiders. By force, they made us give them all our food to the last morsel. In return, they gave us prisons in Siberia and genocide in Ukraine. Countless numbers of children with protruding, frightened eyes, outstretched little hands, pleading for food, crying. Some of us survived, orphans forever. Thank you.
That's beautiful.
If you have any questions, we'll be glad to answer.
We'll take the last testimony and then open up. That's a beautiful poem. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Margarita Smolenska. I am a resident of Clark County. I'm currently studying at Portland State University in Portland. I was born in Ukraine in Kiev, but we immigrated to America in 2001 when I was 4 years old. And so I would like to talk to you a little bit about our personal, like, our family history in Holodomor. So you have, like, one, like, so you can see how one family went through it and, like, the actual. So we have some documentation, some, like, a family tree that has, like, a lot of history in it. So we have actual, like, information about where our family was in this time. So I was born in Kiev, so that's where the star is, and that's where, but originally our family is from Nizhyn, which is where the, like, red dot is. So it's in northern Ukraine. So we had a lot of family, I mean, everyone that was living in Ukraine at the time went through this, but a particular branch of our family really suffered the most from Holodomor, and this was from Yefrosenia, or Frosha. So she is my great-great-grandmother. She's my mother, my mother's mother's mother, mother, like all women on that side. So she survived, obviously, because we are here today, so she would have had to have lived to pass on the family, but she lost 10 of her close family members to forced starvation. So in 1933, her mother died, as well as both of her brothers, Ivan and Andrei, and both of their wives were killed. Ivan also lost 4 out of his 5 children, and Andrei lost his daughter Natalia, and he only had one other child, which was his son Pavlo, and he actually survived. So Frosia, she only, most of her family died. The only people that remained surviving was her husband, who I'll talk with you in a second, as well as one nephew and one niece or nephew. We don't have any documentation surviving to indicate the gender. She also had 3 sisters, but we have no information about what happened to her sisters. So she could have also lost them, and their families might have been killed, but we don't actually have any information or anyone living to be able to tell us what happened to that part of our family. But so also, Frosia, not only did she survive, but her husband did, but it was actually a very interesting story. He almost survived by accident, but he was really important in our family and in our village because he made a really important impact to the people living in our village. So he kind of accidentally saved a lot of people from starving. He was the leader of the, like, commune farm, so he was responsible for giving the harvest to the Soviets when, like, they came for the food, right? That was their industry. So when he saw the order to give all the food, because usually, you know, there's a portion that remains with the village, he thought it was some kind of typo or mistake. So he was like, okay, that can't be real. So he gave the typical amount that was, you know, enough for the village to survive. However, this was against the law because this was a forced famine. So they sentenced him to death and calling him an enemy of the people. And they put him in a prison about to be executed. The prison was overrun, so he wasn't executed immediately. So thankfully, his wife, Frosa, who I just talked about, she had enough time to talk to his friend, who was a close friend of a communist leader. So he had some connections. And they were able to get him out of the prison and able to keep him from being killed. However, he was forced to stay in that village for the rest of his life. And he did, until he died. So he actually saved a lot of people's lives completely by accident, because they had enough food for some people to remain living. Obviously not enough, because, you know, a lot of his family even died in the famine. But so he's also someone who survived and who's part of my family and who's really, and this is just a little piece of our family history that I'd like to share with you today. So you can see how this actually impacted a real family, and it's more than just statistics. Like, this really happened to real people. And I'm, like, here today to, like, as evidence, and, like, we have the history to show you.
Thank you for coming. Are there questions or comments for this panel? This is very moving. I'm one of the people who did not know about this. So thank you for making us aware. This is a time in our history when it's good to be aware of things like this. So,
Is there another panel, ma'am?
No.
This is the only 3 people.
This is all I have signed up. Was there anybody else who wanted to testify? So this is the last panel, your last chance.
Well, I'm going to ask a question then, right, since we're sitting here.
Okay.
And I'm not sure. I'm guessing the gentleman might be the best one to ask the question. One part of remembering history is when you study is to figure out how they did it. And the young lady just pointed out that obviously, and I am aware of this because I've studied Russian history from a military perspective, unfortunately, for 3-4 decades. And so my question is, because I don't know the details, obviously they sent out an original order to take the food, but then how did they follow up on it, and what actually transpired in this? There was a harvest. What transpired, and how did it happen? How did they go about enforcing it?
They were going, that there were special military forces, right. Special military groups coming into each village, coming into each house and taking everything. They were searching house, actually. And if they could see, for example, you know, they were watching houses, if there is, you know, any smoke coming of the chimney. If there was, they were immediately rushing to that house. And if they found anything that people were preparing, they were asking, where did you get it? Why didn't you, you know, give it to the government? This is how it was happening. In almost, you can, it's so hard to describe, because when I'm thinking, when, you know, I read a book that written by Meron Dollot. If you can, you know, get it here. So it's Execution, the name of the book is the Execution by Starvation. I actually found it in the Beaverton Library. It was like a set of 12 audio cassettes. This was a long time ago when I just came to the U.S. and we studied Ukrainian, and I remember we were listening, you know, and my daughter went through like 4 cassettes, and she said, "Dad, I cannot listen to this anymore. It's horrible. It's scary, you know, because that author gives all the details exactly how it was done, you know, in each village. Basically, they were taking everything to the last seed. They were searching houses. People were hiding, you know, some, because you can imagine, to everybody would try to survive, to do whatever it takes. They were hiding food somewhere far away from homes. They were going, you know, with the piece of steel, you know, rods, you know, going into the you know, ground and trying to find if there is anything, you know, that is hidden. So everything was taken out. That's how they were doing this. That's why basically every fourth Ukrainian, you know, disappeared. They did it in 1932, 1933, mostly in the central, northern, and southern Ukraine, and eastern Ukraine. Not in the western Ukraine, because western Ukraine up until 1939, you know, was part of Poland. But they didn't forget about it. They came to our land in 1939, and they repeated this in 1946, 1947 in western Ukraine as well. And my dad told me about this. So, but God, you know, helped western Ukrainians to survive during that year. Our forest produced so much. It was, you know, basically it was filled with mushrooms, you know, wild berries, you name it. And this is how people survived. And there was Ukrainian, you know, partisans fighting against Russians in western Ukraine. They were fighting up until like 1956. So it was hard for them, you know, to move. They wanted basically to move all Western Ukrainians to Siberia, but they were not allowing them to do that. So, because they were, you know, basically coming in into the villages and fighting. So that's what happened. This is the piece of the history.
Some of the things that, you know, they did is also preventing refugees from leaving the areas. Mm-hmm. So people could not leave the area of famine. There were people on the border with Russia who were basically shooting at somebody who tried to cross. And Ukrainians in western Ukraine who found out about Holodomor tried to send aid, but the Soviet Union refused.
Yes.
So they were not allowing any food to come in.
That is correct.
Okay. And then I'm assuming they collectivized what was left?
Yes. And you know, there is a data, you know, that is available, how much grain, how much wheat was sold during this year abroad. And it's enormous. So they basically were taking everything and selling this in order to, you know, get money and developed their industry, you know, so the Soviet Union can basically prosper mm-hmm. in the cost of the Ukrainian nation. More than this, it was probably just more than that. They were afraid because Ukraine declared independence back in 1918, and it was independent for about like 6 to 9 months. And then, you know, Russians, you know, Bolsheviks took it over and made it part of the, you know, former Soviet Union. So thanks God, now we have an independent country since 1991, but you know what's happening there. There is an open war. They still want to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Already Senator Roblin?
Yeah, just to follow up on the question there, because they did go into making these collective farms all over, and they brought Russians in to run those, didn't they? It wasn't Ukrainians that they used to run some of those.
There was like, you know, from Moscow, there was like 180,000 people sent to the villages and to the basically main cities. And of course, they were using local people as well. You know, look what they were doing. And, you know, Maron Dolot is writing in his book about it. They were driving, you know, the whole family to death, leaving one person there and telling him, look, you go to that house, you kill all of the people, you take everything, and this way you will show that you are truthful, you know, you are indeed a communist and you support the Soviet government. This is the way they were acting. You know, basically, you can imagine, you know, there are different people, different characters. Somebody would die and never do that. But some people would just, you know, because of the starvation, they would go and do what they were asked for.
And if I recall correctly, in 1932-33, despite the collectivization, it didn't work very well because they brought the city people out who didn't know how to be farmers. And so the people who knew how to plant the crops that they were supposedly trying to create this new image for, there wasn't anybody left to know how to do the crops. Because I've walked through some of the old collectives in the Ukraine, and it's like, this was a total disaster. I mean, there, not only was there a genocide, but the people that were left, and even some of the Russians that were brought from Moscow, had no idea how to farm. So they just forced relocated them, and then it just perpetuated itself all the way up to the beginning of the invasion.
It is absolutely true. And they were trying to spread this, you know, ideology all over the world. When I, you know, came to the U.S. and was working a graveyard shift, I remember just started at the, you know, Freightliner, and I was working with one, you know, gentleman from Laos, and he was telling me the story how they were trying to bring this, you know, communist idea about the collective farms. That they were inviting people, you know, into the Soviet Union, you know, embassies, showing them basically a lot of food, you know, showing them the video films, how it is nice to live at the collective farm and so on, basically brainstorming them. And he told me what he went through. Basically, they made a starvation over there, or millions of, you know, died there. He told me, you know, they ate everything, you know, all the leaves from the trees, everything that was running around, you know, the python. He was telling me the story how they were just trying to get it out of the hole, you know. So, and he was afraid. He understand that he couldn't get this done on his own because the pond was too big, and the people were passing by, and he was afraid to call them because he understood that he will have to share with them that meat, you know. But finally he said, okay, come here and help me here. This is what, you know, he told me. They ate rats and so on, and all of this. In Ukraine, there was the, you know, acts of cannibalism. People were eating people. You know, the parents were eating their own children, and vice versa. It was so huge disaster. It's indescribable. When you listen to this, as I said, my daughter couldn't listen to this anymore because it's horrible. I can't.
Well, unfortunately, I can describe it to you because I've seen it in multiple countries. So I just hope it doesn't happen here.
Yes.
Yes, that's why it is important. I would propose that, you know, we bring this, you know, a horrible, horrible history into Oregon public schools, because I took a class at Daimler Trucks North America, you know, the presentation class, and I prepared the presentation about Holodomor. And I remember all the people taking the same class, they never heard about this. Not a single person. And they were so, you know, thankful for me bringing this up and telling them this story. So they said, okay, now we're going to try to find out a little bit more to understand actually what happened there. So most of the Americans, they don't know about it because it was covered up. The Soviet propaganda, you know, the Soviet Union was working very hard here on this soil so that Americans would never, you know, learn about it.
But to put it into Oregon perspective, the population of Oregon right now is 4.1 million people. So Holodomor, the estimated number is from 4 to 10 million, entire population of Oregon.
Would vanish in the, like, matter of 18 months.
Wow.
It's about the same size, too, by the way.
Is that right? I thought it was a bigger, but it's about the same size.
And, you know, the soil, as you said, is rich, like Willamette Valley. And in Ukraine, we grow a lot of the same crops as Willamette Valley. So very, a lot of similarities.
Yeah, the black soil, probably the best black soil, is in Ukraine and the U.S. on this planet.
All right, other questions?
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming down to tell your story. Appreciate it. I will close the public hearing on SCR 3 and open a work session on SCR 3.
Madam Chair, I propose amendment to SCR 3 in the form of the inclusion of the dash one amendments, which makes an adjustment to lines 1, 2, and 3 in dash in SCR 3. And Madam Chair, I'll speak to the amendment.
Okay, Senator Farioli has moved the dash one amendment to SCR 3. Discussion, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, we can never know, and we'll never know, the total extent of the genocide that occurred. So it isn't so important that we have the numerical, the numbers are less important than the lesson, which is that the genocide occurred and that it was beyond comprehension. So the number that we are changing simply brings this number more in line with current studies in history. But the numbers are relevant. The fact of the Holocaust, the fact of the genocide, the fact of the many other atrocities that we know of in our not-so-recent and recent history is illustrated again in the Ukraine in this disaster. So let's go ahead and make the amendment, although I don't want the committee or the Senate to be overly concerned about the number. The number will never be known accurately. It is a very large number, and it's almost unthinkable. The lesson here is the genocide, the intentional murder of Ukrainian national and ethnic populations. That's the point here. So, Madam Chair, I commend the dash three amendment, dash one, to SCR 3. Thank you.
Further discussion? All right. Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 3 to the floor with a be adopted Recommendation as amended.
Senator Farrioli has moved SCR 3 as amended to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will have Senator Montes Anderson carry this. And again, thank you all for coming to tell your story. So that completes our business. Committee, we are working on a joint committee meeting with the House Rules Committee on the subject of national popular vote, which will occur during their meeting time, which is a Monday, no, wait a minute, is a Tuesday or Thursday at 3 o'clock. So I'll let you know as soon as we nail down a date. And the alternative was to meet on a Thursday night from 5 to 8. All right. We are adjourned. All right.